$50 for the gray horse that Tom Chaney left. He is easily worth $40. That is $325 total. The ponies have no part in this, said he. I will not buy them. Then I will keep the ponies, and the price for Judy will be $325. Stonehill snorted. I would not pay $325 for winged Pegasus, and that splay-footed gray does not even belong to you. I said, yes, he does. Papa only let Tom Chaney have the use of him. My patience is wearing thin. You are an unnatural child. I will pay $225 and keep the gray horse. I don't want the ponies. I cannot settle for that. This is my last offer. $250. For that, I get a release and I keep your father's saddle. I am also writing off a feed and stabling charge. The gray horse is not yours to sell. The saddle is not for sale. I will keep it. Lawyer Daggett can prove the ownership of the gray horse. He will come after you with a writ of replevin. All right. Now, listen very carefully, as I will not bargain further. I will take the ponies back and keep the gray horse and settle for $300. Now, you must take that or leave it, and I do not much care which it is. I said, I'm sure Lawyer Daggett would not wish me to consider anything under $325. What you get for that is everything except the saddle, and you get out of a costly lawsuit as well. It will go harder if Lawyer Daggett makes the terms, as he will include a generous fee for himself. Lawyer Daggett! Lawyer Daggett! Who is this famous pleader of whose name I was happily ignorant 10 minutes ago? I said, have you ever heard of the Great Arkansas River, Vicksburg, and Gulf Steamship Company? I have done business with the GAV&G, said he. Lawyer Daggett is the man who forced them into receivership, said I. They tried to mess with him. It was a feather in his cap. He is on familiar terms with important men in Little Rock. The talk is he will be governor one day. Then he is a man of little ambition, said Stonehill, incommensurate with his capacity for making mischief. I would rather be a country road overseer in Tennessee than governor of this benighted state. There is more honor in it. If you don't like it here, you should pack your traps and go back where you came from. Would that I could get out from under, said he. I would be aboard the Friday morning packet with a song of thanksgiving on my lips. People who don't like Arkansas can go to the devil, said I. What did you come here for? I was sold a bill of goods. $325 is my figure. I would like to have that in writing for what it is worth. He wrote out a short agreement. I read it over and made a change or two, and he initialed the changes. He said, tell your lawyer to send the money to me here at Stonehill's livery stable. When I have it in my hand, I will remit the extortion money. Sign this. I said, I will have him send the letter to me at the Monarch boarding house. When you give me the money, I will give you the letter. I'll sign this instrument when you've given me $25 as a token of your good faith. Stonehill gave me $10, and I signed the paper. I went to the telegraph office. I tried to keep the message down, but it took up almost a full blank, setting forth the situation and what was needed. I told Lawyer Daggett to let Mama know I was well and would be home soon. I forget what it cost. I bought some crackers and a piece of hoop cheese and an apple at a grocery store and sat on a nail keg by the stove and had a cheap yet nourishing lunch. You know what they say, enough is as good as a feast. When I had finished eating, I returned to Stonehill's place and tried to give the apple core to one of the ponies. They all shied away and would have nothing to do with me or my gift. The poor things had probably never tasted an apple. I went inside the stock barn out of the wind and lay down on some oat sacks. Nature tells us to rest after meals, and people who are too busy to heed that inner voice are often dead at the age of 50 years. Stonehill came by on his way out, wearing a little foolish Tennessee hat. He stopped and looked at me. I said, "I am taking a short nap." He said, "Are you quite comfortable?" I said, "I wanted to get out of the wind. I figured you would not mind." "I don't want you smoking cigarettes in here." "I don't use tobacco." "I don't want you punching holes in those sacks with your boots." "I will be careful. Shut that door good when you go out." I had not realized how tired I was. It was well up in the afternoon when I awoke. I was stiff and my nose had begun to drip. Sure sign of a cold coming on. You should always be covered while sleeping. I dusted myself off and washed my face under a pump and picked up my gun sack and made haste to the federal courthouse. When I got there, I saw that another crowd had gathered, although not as big as the one the day before. My thought was, what? Surely they are not having another hanging. They were not. What had attracted the people this time was the arrival of two prisoner wagons from the territory. The marshals were unloading their prisoners and poking them sharply along with their Winchester repeating rifles. The men were all chained together like fish on a string. They were mostly white men, but there were also some Indians and half-breeds and Negroes. It was awful to see, but you must remember that these chained beasts were murderers and robbers and train wreckers and bigamists and counterfeiters, some of the most wicked men in the world. They had ridden the Hoot Owl Trail and tasted the fruits of evil, and now justice had caught up with them to demand payment. You must pay for everything in this world one way and another. There is nothing free except the grace of God. You cannot earn that or deserve it. The prisoners who were already in the jail, which was in the basement of the courthouse, commenced to shout and catcall through little barred windows at the new prisoners, saying, "Fresh fish," and such like. Some of them used ugly expressions so that the women in the crowd turned their heads. I put my fingers in my ears and walked through the people up to the steps of the courthouse and inside. The bailiff at the door did not want to let me in the courtroom as I was a child, but I told him I had business with Marshal Cogburn and held my ground. He saw I had spunk and he folded right up, not wanting me to cause a stir. He made me stand beside him just inside the door, but that was all right because there were no empty seats anyway. People were even sitting on windowsills. You will think it strange, but I had scarcely heard of Judge Isaac Parker at that time, famous man that he was. I knew pretty well what was going on in my part of the world, and I must have heard mention of him in his court, but it made little impression on me. Of course, we lived in his district, but we had our own circuit courts to deal with killers and thieves. About the only outlaws in our country who ever went to federal court were moonshiners, like old man Jerry Vick and his boys. Most of Judge Parker's customers came from the Indian Territory, which was a refuge for desperados from all over the map. Now, I will tell you an interesting thing. For a long time, there was no appeal from his court, except to the President of the United States. They later changed that, and when the Supreme Court started reversing him, Judge Parker was annoyed. He said those people up in Washington City did not understand the bloody conditions in the territory. He called Solicitor General Whitney, who was supposed to be on the judge's side, a pardon broker, and said he knew no more of criminal law than he did of the hieroglyphics of the Great Pyramid. Well, for their part, those people up there said the judge was too hard and high-handed and too long-winded in his jury charges, and they called his court the Parker Slaughterhouse. I don't know who was right. I know 65 of his marshals got killed. They had some mighty tough folks to deal with. The judge was a tall, big man with blue eyes and a brown billy goat beard, and he seemed to me to be old, though he was only around 40 years of age at that time. His manner was grave. On his deathbed, he asked for a priest and became a Catholic. That was his wife's religion. It was his own business and none of mine. If you had sentenced 160 men to death and seen around 80 of them swing, then maybe at the last minute you would feel the need of some stronger medicine than the Methodist could make. It is something to think about. Toward the last, he said he didn't hang all those men, that the law had done it. When he died of dropsy in 1896, all the prisoners down there in that dark jail had a jubilee, and the jailers had to put it down. I have a newspaper record of a part of that Wharton trial, and it is not an official transcript, but it is faithful enough. I have used it and my memories to write a good historical article that I titled, "You will now listen to the sentence of the law, Otis Wharton, which is that you be hanged by the neck until you are dead, dead, dead. May God, whose laws you have broken and before whose dread tribunal you must appear, have mercy on your soul." Being a personal recollection of Isaac C. Parker, the famous border judge. But the magazines of today do not know a good story when they see one. They would rather print trash. They say my article is too long and discursive. Nothing is too long or too short either if you have a true and interesting tale and what I call a graphic writing style combined with educational aims. I do not fool around with newspapers. They are always after me for historical write-ups, but when the talk gets around to money, the paper editors are most of them cheapskates. They think because I have a little money, I will be happy to fill up their Sunday columns just to see my name in print, like Lucille Biggers Langford and Florence Mabry Whiteside. As the little colored boy says, not none of me. Lucille and Florence can do as they please. The paper editors are great ones for reaping where they have not sown. Another game they have is to send reporters out to talk to you and get your stories free. I know the young reporters are not paid well, and I would not mind helping those boys out with their scoops if they could ever get anything straight. When I got in the courtroom, there was a Creek Indian boy on the witness stand, and he was speaking in his own tongue, and another Indian was interpreting for him. It was slow going. I stood there through almost an hour of it before they called Rooster Cogburn to the stand. I had guessed wrong as to which one he was, picking out a younger and slighter man with a badge on his shirt, and I was surprised when an old one-eyed Jasper that was built along the lines of Grover Cleveland went up and was sworn. I say old. He was about 40 years of age. The floorboard squeaked under his weight. He was wearing a dusty black suit of clothes, and when he sat down, I saw that his badge was on his vest. It was a little silver circle with a star in it. He had a mustache like Cleveland, too. Some people will say, well, there were more men in the country at that time who looked like Cleveland than did not. Still, that is how he looked. Cleveland was once a sheriff himself. He brought a good deal of misery to the land in the panic of 93, but I am not ashamed to own that my family supported him and has stayed with the Democrats right on through, up to and including Governor Alfred Smith, and not only because of Joe Robinson. Papa used to say that the only friends we had down here right after the war were the Irish Democrats in New York. Thad Stevens and the Republican gang would have starved us all out if they could. It is all in the history books. Now, I will introduce Rooster by way of the transcript and get my story back on the rails. Mr. Barlow, state your name and occupation, please.
Mr. Cogburn.
Reuben J. Cogburn. I am a deputy marshal for the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Arkansas, having criminal jurisdiction over the Indian Territory.
Mr. Barlow, how long have you occupied such office?
Mr. Cogburn,
be 4 years in March.
On November 2nd, were you carrying out your official duties?
I was, yes, sir.
Did something occur on that day out of the ordinary?
Yes, sir.
Please describe in your own words what that occurrence was.
Yes, sir. Well, not long after dinner on that day, we was headed back for Fort Smith from the Creek Nation and was about 4 miles west of Weber's Falls.
One moment. Who was with you?
There was 4 other deputy marshals and me. We had a wagon load of prisoners and was headed back for Fort Smith. 7 prisoners. About 4 miles west of Weber's Falls, that Creek boy named Will come riding up in a lather. He had news. He said that morning he was taking some eggs over to Tom Spotted Gourd and his wife at their place on the Canadian River. When he got there, he found the woman out in the yard with the back of her head shot off and the old man inside on the floor with a shotgun wound in his breast.
An objection, Judge Parker.
Confine your testimony to what you saw, Mr. Cogburn.
Yes, sir. Well, Deputy Marshal Potter and me rode on down to Spotted Gourd's place with the wagon to come on behind us.
Deputy Marshal Schmidt stayed with the wagon. When we got to the place, we found everything as the boy Will had represented. The woman was out in the yard dead with blowflies on her head, and the old man was inside with his breast blowed open by a scattergun and his feet burned. He was still alive, but he just was. Wind was whistling in and out of the bloody hole. He said about 4 o'clock that morning, them two Wharton boys had rode up there drunk.
An objection. This is a dying declaration, Your Honor.
Overruled. Proceed, Mr. Cogburn. He said them two Wharton boys, Otis and C.C. by name, had rode up there drunk and throwed down on him with a double-barrel shotgun and said, "Tell us where your money is, old man." He would not tell them, and they lit some pine knots and held them to his feet, and he told them it was in a fruit jar under a gray rock at one corner of the smokehouse. Said he had over $400 in banknotes in it. Said his wife was crying and taking on all this time and begging for mercy. Said she took off out the door, and Otis run to the door and shot her. Said when he raised up off the floor where he was laying, Otis turned and shot him. Then they left.
What happened next?
He died on us. Passed away in considerable pain.
Mr. Spotted Gourd, that is.
Yes, sir.
What did you and Marshal Potter do then?
We went out to the smokehouse, and that rack had been moved, and that jar was gone.
An objection. The witness will keep his speculations to himself. You found a flat gray rock at the corner of the smokehouse with a hollowed-out space under it.
If the prosecutor is going to give evidence, I suggest that he be sworn.
Mr. Barlow, that is not proper examination.
I am sorry, Your Honor.
Marshal Cogburn, what did you find, if anything, at the corner of the smokehouse?
We found a gray rock with a hole right by it.
What was in the hole?
Nothing. No jar or nothing.
What did you do next?
We waited on the wagon to come. When it got there, we had to talk amongst ourselves as to who would ride after the Whartons. Potter and me had had dealings with them boys before, so we went. It was about a 2-hour ride up near where the North Fork strikes the Canadian, on a branch that turns into the Canadian. We got there not long before sundown.
And what did you find?
I had my glass, and we spotted the two boys and their old daddy, Aaron Wharton by name, standing down there on the creek bank with some hogs, 5 or 6 hogs. They'd killed a shoat and was butchering it. It was swinging from a limb, and they had built a fire under a washpot for scalding water. We tied up our horses about 1/4 mile down the creek and slipped along on foot through the brush so we could get the drop on them. When we showed, I told the old man, Aaron Wharton, that we was U.S. Marshals and we needed to talk to his boys. He picked up an axe and commenced to cussing us and blackguarding this court.
What did you do?
I started backing away from the axe and tried to talk some sense to him. While this was going on, C.C. Wharton edged over by the washpot behind that steam and picked up a shotgun that was laying up against a saw log. Potter seen him, but he was too late. Before he could get off a shot, C.C. Wharton pulled down on him with one barrel and then turned to do the same for me with the other barrel. I shot him. And when old man swung the axe, I shot him. Otis lit out for the creek, and I shot him. Aaron Wharton and C.C. Wharton was dead when they hit the ground. Otis Wharton was just winged.
Then what happened?
Well, it was all over. I dragged Otis Wharton over to a blackjack tree and cuffed his arms and legs around it with him sitting down. I tended to Potter's wound with my handkerchief as best I could. He was in a bad way. I went up to the shack, and Aaron Wharton's squaw was there, but she would not talk. I searched the premises and found a quart jar under some stove wood that had banknotes in it to the tune of $420.
What happened to Marshal Potter?
He died in this city 6 days later of septic fever. Leaves a wife and 6 babies.
An objection. Strike the comment. What became of Otis Wharton?
There he sits.
You may ask, Mr. Gowdy.
Thank you, Mr. Barlow.
How long did you say you have been a deputy marshal, Mr. Cogburn?
Gone on 4 years.
How many men have you shot in that time? An objection. There is more to this shooting than meets the eye, Your Honor. I am trying to establish the bias of the witness.